Acting with Asha is sponsored by Actorpreneur Book, now available in paperback or ebook at Amazon, Waterstones, and Samuel French at the Royal Court Theatre. And welcome back to another episode of Acting with Asha. I hope you're having a great week, and we are back to episode 3 of the Ghosted series. Now, I can't really talk about a feature film without meeting the director, or at least introducing him to you. So I am going to introduce a very, very good friend of mine. Actually, the story of how we met, I don't know, I probably explain it in the episode as well. But I'm going to tell you something a little bit sneaky. So I applied to a job about 9 years ago on Mandy.com. And I went for an interview at the Unicorn Theatre in North London somewhere. I can't remember exactly where it is. And I turned up for a lead role. Actually, it wasn't even the lead role in the feature film. It was one of the best friends. So it's like a support lead. And I went for the interview and I met this guy who was sitting at the table because I had to like read in the middle of this cafe. But it was very comfortable and relaxed. And it was Daniel. That's the first time I met him. And I left the audition. And he wrote to me saying, I'd love to actually see you for the lead role in the film, a character called Ebony. And I read the script and I was like, oh my God, I'd actually just been through like a bit of a horrible breakup and had been through a lot of similar things that the character had. And I just related to her so much. And I just sent this, I think it was like 3 pages of why I should play this character and how much I related to her. And then he got me back in for a recall. And because I'd had a bad breakup, I was going out a lot. And I remember basically I went on a date. I got very drunk and I was sick. Sorry, but I was. And I nearly didn't go to the recall. I thought, oh, you know what? I've got a hangover. I'm not going to go. And I did. And I'm so glad I did. I'm sorry, Daniel. I literally turned up and I'd been ill the night before. I don't even think I'd showered. By the way, don't do that. That's not in my book. That's not my advice. That was a very bad advice. But the good thing that I can say that came out of that experience was you never know where something's going to lead. So the few moments where you kind of go, oh, I'm not going to go to this because of this happened, or those moments where we go, ah, actually, I'm not going to go. Go, because my God, that if I hadn't have got that moment, then we wouldn't have made this film and done all the other things and work together like this. So don't miss opportunities because of stupid things you do. But I went and I got the audition, and yay! And me and Daniel made the first film, which was called As Bad As Me. It was one of my most amazing acting experiences, just because I managed to spend like 3 months prepping this character, and I just loved the whole thing. It was my first lead role in any feature film. And after that, we enjoyed working together so much, and I really loved his vision and wanted to work with him. It just was the best working environment I'd been in as an actor, that we thought, oh, well, we really like this genre. Let's write something together. So we spent a few years writing something together, and we've not quite got round to shooting that yet, but it's coming up hopefully this summer, actually. He turned around to me about 6 months ago and said, oh, let's shoot that film. And I said, oh, it's not ready, needs some updating, but I have this script called Ghosted, and that's how it came about. So I've been yabbering on enough, so I'm going to introduce you to Daniel Paquette, who is my business partner and the director, producer and cinematographer of Ghosted. Daniel, welcome to Acting with Asha. How you doing?
I'm very well, Jade, thank you very much.
Thank
I'm very
you.
Well. Yeah. Glad to be here finally. Heard so much about it, so I'm glad to be here. One of your guests.
You are one of my guests.
Yes.
So I'm going to start off with my usual questions. Where were you born?
I was born in London, Notting Hill. Yeah, I've always lived in London. I did spend a couple of months in America doing some work, but I've always lived in London. Yeah, London, England.
And was there any inkling that you'd go into the filmmaking industry?
No, not at all. I'm always good at drawing. I was always happy to draw. So when I left school after sixth form, I entered into the architecture world.
Did you? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I worked for a civil and structural engineering company as a trainee draftsperson because I was very fond of drawing. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, there was this guy, weasel of a guy, I have to call him that, who was quite racist. to.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
You can go further than Weasel. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah. He found it, if you like, his secondary role to say racist jokes. Just like, you know, and only he found the jokes funny.
That's awful.
Yeah, as well, a team of about 10 people, ranging from, you know, the top engineers to the sort of admin staff. And no, well, actually, he was quite careful who he said his jokes around. Mm. But they were constant. And, you know, had I been one of my brothers, I've got a few brothers and a few sisters. Had I been one of my brothers and one of them in particular, I can think of, or one of my sisters who I can think of in particular, it would have ended a bit differently. But it was an apprenticeship. So I went back to the Chambers of Commerce who put up this apprenticeship for us. And I said to them, this is what's going on. I'm experiencing racism. So they said, okay. There were three other industries you can have an apprenticeship in. One is business, one is travel, and one is the film industry.
So rather than actually solve the problem, they were just moving
you. They just moved me, yeah.
Wow,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, so I said, oh, film as well. I said, okay, let me try film. Mm. Travel was interesting, and so was business, but film sounded more exciting, you know. So then I got a role in this company who had a preview theatres. Actually, they had three or four preview theatres where they would preview movies to film critics before the movies were released. And they would also do, they also had cutting rooms, and they would provide cutting equipment to Pinewood Studios, to Shepperton Studios, and they also had these cutting rooms within their offices in Soho. So for me, I was in a really exciting place. I was watching movies all day long. I was providing editing equipment to industry editors. So it was just like, wow, is this how films are made? You know, okay, these are the critics that come in and watch films on a daily basis and write about these films before they're released. And I get a chance to see films, you know, like over and over again. And every time I watch particular films, it really excited me. I really thought, oh, I want to know more about this whole film industry, you know.
How old were you?
I was probably about 19 or 20 at the time. And so for me, I just wanted to know more. And I then came across a film shoot. They were filming a music video not far from where I lived. And I thought, right, I've got experience. I'm in the industry, but not on set, hands on. This is what I want. So when I saw this music video being filmed, I approached them on the street and said, look, I'm in the industry, but I have no production experience. And I would love some production experience. And this was a team, a husband and wife team. The wife was the director. The husband was the cinematographer. And they made music videos. And they said, okay, no problem. We'll give you a call. Literally 3 days later, they called me. And I worked on about a dozen productions for them. I became like their main production assistant. And that was, again, more excitement for me. They really valued me. They really, you know, respected me. And, you know, I just wanted more. I just wanted more. So I think then it became obvious to me, this is where my passion lied. I really became passionate about film. Then I found a course, same within the Notting Hill area. And it was a basic video production course. I got to understand a bit more about cameras, got to hold a camera, a little video camera. But you got to understand how shots work, why they work, where they put them. I did a script writing course. And I suppose I was now in the world of film, you know. And again, wanted more, became hungry and just wanted to do more.
Did you have a side job around this, or were you actually, you know, surviving off filmmaking?
Well, for years, my side work was retail. Even when I went on to establish myself as a video assist. So video assist is where the director and the producer would sit around from one monitor to several monitors, watching camera setups and speaking to the cameramen, asking them to pan and tilt and pull out and so on, you know, as they're composing the shots. And what we'd also do is record each shot, so the director could have that shot played back. And if they were happy, then they would move on. So until I became established in that role, I would have retail work to keep me going. So I've worked in Selfridges, Marks and Spencer's twice, John Lewis, Disney Store. All those jobs were fillers.
So just not just actors doing the side hustles as well?
Oh, big time side hustle. I remember Disney Store. Disney Store was probably the most... Disney Store and the factory. Disney Store, I was at Disney Store and they were really fond of me. This is where I came across the name Dan P. I never really used Dan P before. I never really liked the name Danny. I prefer Daniel. Daniel's my name, but I always get introduced as Danny, and then so it's sort of the name that followed me. But when I was at Disney Store, I was in the warehouse for them, and they really, really fond of me. They called me Dan P, Dan P. And then I said to them, right, I got a call to work on The World Is Not Enough. I think that's a Bond 19 film. And
casually, just a call to come work on a Bond film.
Yeah, and then I said to them, yeah, I'm leaving, guys. I handed in my notice. And they're like, nah, Dan P, you can't leave. You've got to stay. And it's like, you know, it was really nice. It was really nice. And that's when the name Dan P, I became quite fond of it. I really remember that retail job. And then another retail job I really remember was I was in a factory, actually. Not retail, actually. I was in a factory cutting up mobile phone cases.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 12 hours a day. It was a killer. Whoa. It was mentally, it was a bit physically a killer. It was 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. every day. And it was so monotonous. It was just a brain killer. I'm just sitting there. And then they you know, these phone cases will come off and you'll have a little standing knife and you have to shave off a bit.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And I got a call to work on Tomorrow Never Dies. So on Bond 18, I think that was. And I remember I had to say to them, I had to lie, which I wasn't, you know, at the time, I didn't see lying as an issue. It's different now, but I did at the time. So I had to say to them, because the production assistant said to me, I had worked with her on a Bill Murray film before for 3 months. And she said to me, Dan, we're all going on to Bond 18, Tomorrow Never Dies. If I can get you onto it, I promise I will. Mm. Her name was Virginia Murray, really nice production assistant from this Bill Murray film. And, I said, all right, no problem. You know, I'll look out for your call. But in the meantime, I'm going to find something else to do. So I worked in this factory and it was a killer. It was during the summer. All my mates were saying like, Dan, you're coming out tonight.
Like,
particularly Saturday nights was a killer because of seven. Can you imagine 7 p.m., the sun shining, people are getting ready to rave. And I'm getting ready to go work in the factory for like 12 hours.
Oh,
so it was a killer.
God,
it was
awful,
a killer.
Yeah.
And then she called me. Virginia called me. And I called up this factory, said, yeah, I'm not feeling well. I'm not coming in. And I thought, right, I can only do this for like, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks. And in that time, when working on Tomorrow Never Dies, I had to really hustle the production manager for him to give me a full-time job. Because at the time, they just needed someone additional for that location.
Mm.
It was in Brent Cross Shopping Centre. They were using the car park for this chase scene. But apparently, when they were going to go back to Paramount Studios, they potentially didn't need someone else to support in that department. But I managed to speak to, you know, the production manager and, you know, sort of convince him that I'm needed when we go back to Pinewood. So 2 weeks... ended up being 3 months, the rest of the film. So I could hand my notice into the factory. And
it must have been nice.
I'm not coming back. Yeah, it was such a good feeling, man. It was such a good feeling, you know. It became a sort of world of possibilities. What do I do? You know, up until that point, I'd had different experiences. I'd worked before on, the Bill Murray film, The Man Who Knew Too Little. Again, we went there for 2 weeks. It was myself and two other guys one girl. We got our CVs got selected from the Borough of Kensington and Chelsea to have work experience for 2 weeks on The Man Who Knew Too Little. And the 2 weeks turned into 3 months. A British actress called Anna Chancellor, she liked our contribution and said, why don't you give these guys, you know, the full run?
Yeah.
Why send them back after 2 weeks? Like a bit of a tease, really, you know. So they said to us, hey, guys, we're going to keep you on this production for 3 months, the remainder of the whole production. And we were like, wow, this is like great. So, that experience was quite interesting because I was in the sound department and I never really wanted to do sound. But I respected sound.
Mm.
And the sound guy I was working for, he was very well respected. And he wasn't happy that I didn't want to do sound in the long run.
Yeah.
But I was in his department. He sort of thought, well, I should have someone who only wants to do sound in the long run. But it wasn't like that, you know. Sometimes you do, particularly at a young age, you work in different departments until you find what you really want to do, you know. So I did get invited to the camera department. But I thought, well, let me stick it out, because you're not always going to work with people that you see eye to eye with. You know, there's so many people in a crew, sometimes depending on what you're working on. And sometimes you just have to learn to just do what you got to do and make the best of the situation, you know. So I wasn't discouraged at all when working with this old school guy, I'd like to call him. I learned a lot. And it was a fine experience. It was a good experience, you know. I just didn't want to do sound in the long run. That's all it was. But it got me to respect sound, appreciate sound. And it was a good experience.
So yeah. When did you make the transition to becoming a director, or realise that that's what you wanted to do?
I think when I studied. I did a City and Guilds TV and video competencies course. That was a 9-month course, 3 days a week. And I just think then, because you're able to make, you're encouraged, in fact, to make your own things. So if you want to do costume, or if you want to do, you know, whatever role, because you've got to make your short films on those courses, you can dive into the particular roles that you want to pursue. So on that course, I dived into camera work and directing. And then, it established in me that, okay, yeah, I like to, you know, to work with people in this way. So I don't see myself not being able to work with actors, you know. And I think there was Spike Lee, he had done She's Got to Have It. So there was someone out there as well who was quite inspirational.
Mm.
When you hear the sort of journey, you know, making the micro budget, back then it was a micro budget film, and it had done critically well, you know, the fans, the movie critics really liked it. They really embraced it, because I think it was an audacious attempt to compete with the big films out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had it was shot in black and white, micro budget. That's what, not all black and white films are micro budget, but that was a sense of where it was coming from. It's really budget. And they had a 20-minute sequence. So he was able to say, look, I'm going to do it my way. You know, I'm going to try to compete with my storytelling techniques, you know, my way. I'm not going to copy anybody else. You know, I have those who have inspired me, but this is how I'm going to do it. And I think it was encouraging to see someone like myself, a black guy, kind of from nowhere, giving it a go. So, you know, for me, it was like, well, okay, yeah. So, you know, because you do look to other people who have done things that maybe you want to do and see how well they've got on.
Mm.
And at that time, he had gotten well. You know, he had gotten well. And there was a lot of, there were other people that he had inspired who were able to make films. So it's like, okay, you know, you're in the minority, but you'll always be in the minority.
Yeah.
But things can still happen.
Tell me about your first experience on set as a director, because you write as well. Was it a project that you wrote and produced, or?
Yeah, so that was something. Well, we can talk about that, actually, because that was the film we made.
Was that the first thing? You went straight in with a feature?
No, actually, I made a 30-minute film.
Yeah.
Yeah, called Best Friends.
Okay.
Yeah, so where I studied at two places. I did a very short course at a place called Paddington Arts, and then I did a 9-month course, the City and Guilds course. That was at a place called North Kensington Video and Drama Project. And those two places were like, you know, 2 miles apart. They knew each other. They had a working relationship with each other. So when they gave my script to Paddington Arts, they contacted North Kensington Drama Project and said, oh, we've got Daniel's script here. It's a half-hour drama about best friends. Why don't we make it? So the two colleges came together and, you know, did an audition process, looked at the script, got the script writing tutors in, you know, tweaked it here and there. And We made the film.
Cool.
Yeah, we were casted for roles and for crew roles, for actor roles. And then we made it. And again, it was very encouraging. You know, it showed me you have to kind of do for self. Mm. You know, you don't always have someone coming knocking your door. You've got to go knocking people's door sometimes, you know. So you have to have stuff. You have to, you know, people are going to, you know, it's one thing saying to someone, I want to direct. And then they'll turn around and say, direct what? Have you got a script? So you kind of have to have things done yourself, you know, to a point. Either you get scripts from people or you write your own scripts. That was always my understanding, you know. And like I said, with Spike Lee, he's written, direct. He writes his films, he directs his films, he stars in his films, and he produces films, you know. So I suppose, you know, the acting thing is something I've looked at, but not really explored. But in terms of, right, okay, you have to write, you have to direct, you have to shoot sometimes, you have to produce sometimes. I understood that's something that I have to take on board, you know, and embrace. Not run away from.
So tell me about your first feature film.
Yeah.
As Bad As Me, which is how we met.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was for me something that I see myself as someone who, or I see what I need to do is be resourceful. So I wrote As Bad As Me, which is a relationship drama, and just based it around what I had access to, which was my flat, my car, the communal space around my flat, and the surrounding streets. And it was like, well, okay, how do I tell a story with these, you know, on a very minimalistic budget, very minimalistic location, you know, or access to locations. Everything was very minimalistic. But the good thing about As Bad As Me, it demonstrated to me the hunger that is out there for, you know, film production. And that was on cast and crew sites, because, I used Mandy, and that's how we met on Mandy. I used Mandy to reach out to people, and there was a lot of interest, even when you can be a bit, some people can be, and I was, you can be a bit, oh, I've got to put no budget. Is anyone going to apply? You know, and Mandy even shows you how many people looked at your, you know, setup, and how many people actually showed an interest in terms of applying. So it was encouraging, you know, and you get to meet quite a few actors who are probably not right for the roles and the production you're casting for now, but you can consider them for later down the line, you know. And I think that, because that was my first real experience of reaching out. I had to do this personally. When I made the half-hour drama, the colleges put out, you know, the sort of course for casting and stuff like that, so I didn't have to do it. But for As Bad As Me, I had to do it. And it was like, wow. So even though this is, you know, a one-man band kind of thing, you know, end up being four or five of us that shot it, no budget, no one knows what's going to happen to it, there's a huge amount of interest. So just imagine you've got more resources, you've got a bit more of a budget, and then how, you know, what would the interest be like then?
Yeah.
You know, so I think what was good is we had a schedule of 3 weeks, you know, and it was done. And it was like, wow, you know, it was so encouraging. So, so encouraging, you know.
Can I ask you a few questions which actors might find handy? So when you're going through an audition process, can you name me some things that make you, what do you like about an actor? What makes you like them, or what turns you off them? Because I always remember you saying about, this guy turned up and he was really scruffy, like he looked like a tramp, and you were like, why has he not made an effort? So what kind of things like that would you say from first meeting an actor would you know, kind of turn you on, turn you off?
I think, you know, the first thing you see about an actor, whether it's they're coming for an audition or it's a headshot or on TV, they... You know, I suppose, no, in fact, when you're casting, when you're looking through headshots, the first thing you see is what someone looks like. So I think the most disturbing thing for me personally is when I get to meet them in person and they ain't what I expected.
Mm.
That's disturbing.
That bothers you a lot.
Yeah, because you based your reaching out to them. Okay, you've read, you know, their credits and so on. Maybe you've watched their showreel, but you've based your reaching out to them as well as, you know, you've put a lot of emphasis on what they look like. A lot of has gone into what they look like. So when they come, when you meet them and they don't look anything like it, you sort of think, have I been had here? Particularly if they don't have a show rule. So if it's just meeting them off the photo, if they've got a show rule and they're potentially they're in the middle of a job, so their hair's blonde for whatever reason, you know, that's different. Because you maybe have said, well, we're going to shoot in 2 months. So they are aware of that and they'll get their hair looking back the way it should be. But if it's almost like a blind date, you know, where you say, right, I look like this, but actually when they turn up, they look like the opposite. That's no good for me.
Mm.
That's no good. I think that's a bit of a turn off. I think the other thing, you know, it's, you know, we know, we know things get in the way of, you know, what we'd like to do. But when you haven't prepared for your audition and you've had the time, it's difficult to get out of that.
Mm.
You know, I did have an actor come and he said, I haven't learnt the lines, you know, and I know he got the lines in enough time. And this actually was for our first shoot. We were shooting a sitcom. And he turned up and then he was so blasé about, first of all, he actually turned up different colour hair.
Mm.
He didn't have any explanation for that. And then he didn't know the lines. And then...
That was on an actual shoot rather than audition.
That was on an actual shoot.
Most important thing, people, know your lines.
He then turned around to say, well, we can just shoot it bit by bit. Well, what if I wanted to do it in one take? Mm. What if I wanted to do it in one take? You know, Victoria is being shot. It was shot in one take. Birdman was shot in 6 takes. Suppose I wanted to shoot this sitcom in 2 takes. 15 minutes and 15 minutes. So then that throws that plan right out the window. You know, you can't assume that you've got a solution for how the director wants to shoot what you're auditioning for or what you're going to be acting in. You don't know what's on the director's mind. You know, he might not want to tell you. You know, or if he wants to tell you, the minimum you need to do is just know your lines. And if you don't know your lines, communicate to him. So he can then do an all-nighter with you or 2 nights, or how much more time do you need? Do I change the schedule around? There's ways around it. But I think, you know, it's very difficult to get past you not knowing your lines, because, you know, if you turn up for an audition and you know you can't get into character because you don't know the lines, he's not going to see your real potential. You know, it's not possible for him to see your true potential, because you're going to be trying to understand the role as you're auditioning. Whereas if you understand the role, even if, you know, you're not spot on with the lines, but you understand the character. So you've done a little bit of prep. The thing is, actors, you know, directors and producers they're sport for choice. They will want you because of the way you look, but if they can't have you, they will find someone else. It's knowing that actually I'm fortunate. It's like if I get a directing role, I'm fortunate.
Mm.
Why? Because there's a lot of other directors that could have got it.
Yeah.
There's a lot. there's whoever this production is, there's a lot of people that they've worked with in the past or people that know other people. So if I've got it, I'm fortunate. So I have to show my appreciation, because it's not something that I can take for granted.
So let's talk about Ghosted. How was the casting process on that for you?
Oh, well, again, I think a bit like As Bad As Me, it was really encouraging. I think, I remember speaking to you and you were sharing with me the type of show reels that you were receiving from the actors, and you were already excited. And I think that already generated a buzz inside of me. But then when we started to audition the actors, it really then, brought alive the potential of Ghosted. There are different stages, and the audition stage is very, very early within the whole process, but it is a stage that we can get. Actors can bring so much when they're prepared. They know a little bit. They know enough to translate to the director and producer. When they know enough about the character, and they're brave enough to show what they know, it does a lot for the producer and director. It really does. So that little extra bit of preparation, like I said, we all know things get in the way. Oh, I didn't sleep last night. Oh, I had a job, and I've come straight from the job. We know all of this, but you want to show your full potential. So one way or another, when you come to audition, I mean, Jade, we're not going to mention any names. We met some actors that we just loved, right?
Yeah.
We met some that just stood out. They didn't have to explain, spent all night reading the lines. They didn't have to explain. When they auditioned, they understood the character.
Mm-hmm.
They understood the genre. And we could see their full potential.
Yeah.
And even if they didn't get the role, it's like, wow, this stands out for me.
And there's a lot of people that are still in, I know, my mind that I'm like...
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember people that I auditioned like 8-9 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I think, as I say to other filmmakers, this is not the NHS. This is not the police that are in need of a recruitment drive. This industry in front of the camera, behind the camera, I think it's fair to say it's slightly overpopulated.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that want to make films, that want to act in films, that want to... Oh, there'll be that percentage that will drop off for whatever reason. But there's a lot of people that want to make films. So, the competition is fierce. And, I think it's only... You're only helping yourself. When I did my MA in filmmaking about 18 months ago now, I was really happy because it helped me go deeper into my preparation, into my understanding, because I didn't want to just think that, okay, what I know is okay. I didn't want to think that I know enough. No, I needed to learn more. And even after doing the MA, I know I still need to learn more. But it left me thinking, wow, that's why things were plateauing out. It's because my prep didn't go as deep as it needed to go. But, and the point I'm making to the actors is, does your preparation go as far as it should? Not saying, because sometimes we know you only get the self-tape request 2 days before. So you're limited with how much prep you can do. But if it's very specific, very detailed, it can make a big difference in your career.
Daniel, thank you for coming on the show. It's been amazing.
No problem, my pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Acting with Asha. If you like what you heard, give us a follow and subscribe. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Acting with Asha. Until next time, bye.